Our second guest, and we'll be talking to him first, actually, will be Eve Engler. And Eve has been writing about this phenomenon of strange relationship between Western powers and this strongman, African strongman, used an old-fashioned expression, Paul Kagame. I believe Eve is on the line. Are you there, Eve?
How's it going, Phil?
Not bad. And thanks for joining us. And Eve, you've written several times about Paul Kagame, but particularly you're interested. You've taken up this matter of why is it that he goes under the radar all the time? Canada, the United States are quick to pick on or pick out African leaders they don't like, and they even talk openly about removing them. But this one, they're rather fond of, and so fond that they've passed him on to the sports world. And now, I read recently that there's been a conference of the NBA owners, a special one, where they brought a CNN anchor to come and do a fawning interview with him, and it was all about how he knows he's a fan and who's his favorite player. It was rather peculiar when you think of who he is. Talk about that, if you will.
Yeah, I mean, the NBA and the Toronto Raptors have full-on embraced Paul Kagame in a way that doesn't seem to be the case with almost any other political leader. Masai Ujiri, the president of basketball operations at the Raptors, has recently was just in Kigali to inaugurate a new basketball stadium, and he's pictured with Kagame put out a Instagram post celebrating Kagame. And this is just most recent example. This was on July 26th. And then this is just the most recent example. It's back in December. There was a Giants of Africa event that for Nelson Mandela, celebrating Nelson Mandela at a Raptors game. That's an initiative that Ujiri has spearheaded. And Kagame was part of that. He's listed in that as one of the endorsers of the Giants of Africa. And Ujiri met with Kagame at the G7 when it was held by in Quebec City area last year. It just repeated. Kagame's son was part of this training that took place back in 2015 in Kigali, launching that Ujiri was at. So it's a full-on embrace. And back in 2016, when Kagame was invited to the NBA All-Star Weekend in Toronto, Toronto Star reporter asked him about it. You know, talked about the human rights violations, the lack of democracy, and
in war with his neighbors. This is not, you know, if we were to look at it only as a question of nation state. This is a nation or state rather that has big border problems with his neighbors, and his neighbors do not appreciate it. Burundi has had incursions from Rwanda. Rwanda harbored people who were calling openly, using American radio, African radio, to call for the overthrow of the Burundian government. His troops are in Congo. He's closed his border with Uganda. So, but Mr. Ujiri chooses this moment to say he's a visionary,
and he frames it like in the photo he put out with Kagame 2 weeks ago. He has a shirt on with a little picture of the African continent on it. So he's framing this as sort of like a Pan-Africanist kind of position. And it, you know, there is no African leader that has more African blood on his hands than Paul Kagame. I was recently talking to somebody among the Ugandan elite, and her feeling was that a whole bunch of assassinations that have been taking place in Uganda recently are the work of Kagame. Obviously, there's a border closure. There's you know, all kinds of political intrigue between Museveni and Kagame, and that's his former ally. That's the person who supported him, conquering.
They were once good friends. This is one of the stories that is also very curious. The sponsor of his invasion was Museveni, and with whom he now has bad blood. This is something I know you've, of course, almost started off on the subject in your writing. You are yourself an outstanding athlete. There is a tendency, I shouldn't say a tendency, it's a policy, if they can, to incorporate sport into the, let's say, the imperial project. For example, we can't now have a CFL game, an NFL game, without Army and Navy personnel and people jumping out of planes. And they really like to bring these things together as a way to, there's a new term, sportswash people.
Yeah, you can't go to a Raptors or a Maple Leafs game without walking past commemorations to the Canadian military. There's a series of different commemorations up at the stadium, at the arena. No, I mean, this is from the standpoint of imperialism in general. Obviously, as many high profile figures, getting behind a project that's beneficial. I think in the specific to Kagame, he is still remains, despite all the evidence and facts, he remains a darling of the liberal imperialist world, and the president of the Raptors, is part of that and has sees his personal advancement, and sees the world through that lens, and if that means becoming a good friend with this brutal dictator, that's fine, and then to present it as if it's part of African liberation. I think that's a level of chutzpah that's fairly impressive. But Justin Trudeau would be proud, and Barack Obama would be proud, and whatnot. Mm-hmm.
I wonder if people, how many people realize, but at the time of the big episode that in some ways has been a modern watershed in terms of people's understanding of what U.S. imperialism is after. The destruction of Libya, the overthrow and murder of Gaddafi, the only African leader or the loudest African leader in support of the regime change was Paul Kagame. And when the U.S. invaded Iraq the first time, Paul Kagame supported the invasion. And whereas all the other African leaders were solid and saying, no, we don't want to see, this kind of neo-colonial, neo-imperial action, I guess those were his bona fides.
Yeah, and you see Rwandan troops. I mean, just a group of Rwandans just left the UN mission in Haiti. They've been in the UN mission in Haiti. They've been in Somalia. They've been, Rwandan troops have often been sort of employed in the different UN missions that Washington is pushing, and Kagame also has this growing relationship with Israel. Lots of training that takes place, Rwandan troops being trained in Israel, and that's part of this.
I wonder too if that's part of it, because I think a lot of basketball fans were shocked. Actually, certainly, would they find when the owner announced that if they won. If the Raptors became the NBA champions, he said, I'm going to take the team to Israel. Apparently, that remark he's kind of either withdrawn it or ceased to say it. But, we come back to, again, the athletes. They're not actually, you don't own them. You can't actually make them go, right? And I believe you and others, didn't you sign or draft a petition saying, don't do that?
Yeah, I signed that petition, but there was actually Karen Rodman was the one who launched that in Toronto and did some very good work, and thousands of people signed that. So I think that whether the players were ever planning on following the owner's position or not, I don't know. But I think the level of public discussion about it made the chance that players are, I think it's highly unlikely that the Raptors players are going to follow the owners to go to Israel.
It's interesting that basketball is certainly an international sport. It has been the rising sport. People all over the world love the players and the personalities and the excitement of the game. And in Toronto, I think it's very clear that people from all over the world who are now here, Canadians, they identify, but they also remembered, they have their own histories, which gives them their understanding of the world, and they probably were surprised to hear that somebody would be thinking about taking the team to Israel.
For sure. I mean, I don't think that Israel's particularly, basketball fans sort of skew younger and skew to, generally darker than hockey fans, and Israel is not. I think there's a fair bit of sympathy among fans of basketball towards Palestinians more than Israel. Mm-hmm. In the case of the Raptors, of course, Larry Tannenbaum is one of the people who set up the Center for Israel and Jewish Affairs because he viewed that the Canadian Jewish Congress wasn't sufficiently anti-Palestinian enough, and so I think it's that in that case would be something completely driven by ownership and not by fans of the game or the players themselves, for that matter.
Mm-hmm. This is Eve Engler, by the way, and you can just Google Eve Engler and you get the columns. I love that. And Eve, I got to make sure that I ask you this. I don't know the details of it, but I understand that from various places that the U.S. is really tightening now in a dangerous way the blockade, basically, and sanctions against Venezuela, and a ship that was passing through the Panama Canal line with food was stopped, I understand. But you have the general background. What is the idea that it's just static? It doesn't appear to be a static situation. That when the administration speaks, and I mean the U.S. administration, they aren't... they're not backing off from the idea they're going to try to break Venezuela, and I think you have some information on that too.
They're not backing off. I mean, basically, they blocked 25,000 tons of soy from getting to Venezuela. I mean, this is what helping the people of Venezuela is supposed to be all about. We talk about how Venezuelans don't have enough food, and then we do what we can to stop them from getting any new food. That's what helping Venezuelans is all about. Yeah. And
it's also, isn't it criminal, actually, according to stop food and medicine reaching your people?
Yeah, I mean, the sanctions are all, these unilateral sanctions are all, contrary to UN regulations, international law. And this is, the Trump administration is talking about a full-fledged embargo of Venezuela, and they're saying that, they're going to start sanctioning companies from other countries that do business with Venezuela, which in theory should threaten, business people in Canada, corporate world, many countries outside of the U.S. Mm-hmm. But the Canadian government is basically going along with this. The Canada has four rounds of its own sanctions against Venezuela. It's in reference to the full American embargo. Chrystia Freeland said that we're going to look into it. But Elliot Abrahams, the Trump administration's point person on Venezuela, was up in Ottawa a week ago.
Elliot Abrahams was in Ottawa?
He's the Trump administration's advisor for Venezuela, who has a whole nasty criminal record.
He's a convicted felon, so he'd be the guy to come talk to us because we have values here. He shares our values, I understand.
Exactly. He's a law and order man. What he said coming out of that was that the Canadian officials had agreed with him that we should be putting pressure on the EU to ramp up sanctions on Venezuela, and basically making this whole claim that Maduro government's people are living large in Europe, and we got to pressure Europe to stop this situation. And this is, of course, what we're talking about really is stopping, 25,000 tons of soy entering the country, and Canada probably won't go to that point of full-on embargo or joining the embargo. But just the rounds of sanctions that Canada has done has provided all kinds of legitimacy to the American moves, and I think it's quite clear that Americans see it as important in terms of pressuring European countries to go in this direction. That Canada is a sort of important piece in that, because Canada is viewed as, you know, Trudeau the liberal and not the, you know, nasty Donald Trump. Uh-huh. So you got a situation where Canada's, you know, if not directly involved in this specific blocking of food entering the country, is, you know, has its hands on supporting this policy more broadly.
Yeah, and recognizing a pretender, which, by the way, there's a term we ought to get your comments on. It's become sacred business to say, Russians mustn't meddle in our internal affairs, and we've got to put up a super wall, cyber wall, to catch anybody meddling. But my goodness, what you describe in Venezuela and the Lima Project and the recognition of this pretender, that's all egregious meddling, right?
Yeah, I mean, I would, you know, if they had 100th of Canada's meddling in Venezuela on Russia in the last U.S. presidential elections, you know, there's not even, you know, 100th or 1,000th of the evidence of equivalent level of meddling, and, you know, look how much attention they've given to that. And it's naked double standards. It's throwing all the rules of international law out the window. It's, yep, you know, just because we're doing it, it's ipso facto a moral endeavor.
It's what the Five Eyes does is always correct, I guess.
It's always correct. And in, you know, in this case, when we talk about food being blocked from entering this country, you know, prominent member of the opposition, an economist in New York, a Venezuelan opposition, he's talking about the possibility of famine developing in Venezuela because of this level of sanction. There was an op-ed, even got into the New York Times and a story in the Financial Times talking about this. And, you know, Canadian media doesn't mention the fact that the boat of full of soy was blocked, right? You can't even find that in the Canadian media. So you know, when the head of the UN, when Michelle Bachelet, puts out a report saying that there's human rights violations in Venezuela, that gets tons of media attention in the Canadian media. When she, yes, 2 days ago, criticizes the Americans for the embargo, you can't find her comments in, you know, in any Canadian media. The media is central to this whole process of legitimating and justifying this incredible interference.
You have to give them credit. They hear their master's voice. It's Eve Engler. Eve, you're writing great stuff, and particularly that article on the embrace of Kagame by the NBA, and particularly the general manager, I guess, of the Raptors, is terrific. Thank you very, very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, bye-bye. And that was Eve Engler. We're going to we'll take a break for some music, and I will be back. And at 5:30, we're going to be talking to Yash Tendon.